This episode of The Fifth Kind is brought to you by Ancient Knowledge Academy, a learning community for anyone interested in human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to find out more. The Himalayas, the rooftop of the world, spanning the territories of China, India, Nepal, Bhutan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Straddling the Chinese and Indian regions of Tibet and Kashmir are some of the most rugged and majestic mountainscapes on planet Earth. This forbidding terrain provides the perfect place of seclusion for communities of monks and pilgrims, practitioners of ancient pathways of enlightenment.
I've had the privilege of traveling all around the world to some incredible places, but I have to say that horse trekking as a boy in the foothills of the Himalayas has to be one of the highlights of my life so far. Kashmir is absolutely stunning country, and I can see why it's disputed over. Quite aside from the religious and geopolitical differences, it is absolutely beautiful country, ethnically diverse, fertile, spectacular. And it's a part of the world with very deep history.
In the deep history of Kashmir, are narratives which point to a controversial revision of our understanding of one of history's most significant and enigmatic figures, Jesus of Nazareth. Deeply historical claims maintained by the communities of Hemis Monastery in Leh in Ladakh and the founders of the shrine at Rose Bal in Srinagar.
In the written records of the monastery at Hemis near the town of Leh in Ladakh are references to a figure by the name of Isa, a young man in his 20s from the Levant who stayed there for a couple of years on his travels during the first century of the Common Era. And the records say that this was perhaps the third monastic community in India in which this young Isa had stayed. The other claim is from Srinagar, the shrine at Rose Bal. And there we find the burial place of a man from the Levant in the first century of the Common Era, a pilgrim who became a healer, a teacher, and the leader of the community of the healed, by the name of Yus Asaf. And he's buried there in an interesting fashion because it's not done according to local custom, but according to ancient Jewish custom, with the body facing from west to east. And the story goes that he lived in this community until the age of 80, when he died of old age. The other interesting detail there is that there is a bronze relief giving more information about who this Yus Asaf may have been. So not only was he from the Levant at the same time period as Jesus, but the bronze relief shows through the markings in the feet that this was a man who had survived a Roman crucifixion. Now, it's not physical proof of anything. It's a narrative tradition. But again, it sounds some very familiar notes.
Christian orthodoxy has struggled to respond to these ancient narratives, whose implications would appear to strike at the very foundations of mainstream Christianity. But do they? What are the issues created by the stories of Jesus' presence in India, and in particular by the claims of Hemis, and Rosa Ball.
The Hemis story doesn't conflict in any way with the canonical Orthodox stories about Jesus, because there is that huge missing section in the story of Jesus' life. The challenge is really to the authority of the church, because the church really wants to be the single sole repository of all reliable information about Jesus. It speaks for Jesus in the world. And the church is uncomfortable with other communities and other countries belonging to other cultures saying, oh, well, we know some other things about Jesus. That's really not allowed, because it is a challenge to the monopoly that the church wants to have on the histories and stories of Jesus of Nazareth. The narrative claim of the shrine at Rosa Ball is rather more seismic, because there they are claiming to have the body of the deceased Jesus. And that runs totally against the mainstream Orthodox view of the resurrection of Jesus. And for a long time, Christianity has run on the proposition that the credibility of Jesus as a teacher and a savior and the divine Son of God rests upon the historicity of his resurrection. The claim at Rosa Ball challenges the Orthodox story of Jesus dying at the age of 33 and resurrecting by a supernatural act of God, then ascending to the right hand of the Father in the heavens. Those narratives conflict with one another. Both cannot be true.
For centuries, Christians have taught that the credibility of Jesus as a spiritual teacher rests upon the historicity of his resurrection. The stories of Jesus' later life in India and his death in Kashmir at the age of 80 would appear to be incompatible with the traditional Christian understanding of his resurrection. But is that really the case?
It really depends what you mean by resurrection, because at the beginning of Christianity, resurrection meant more than one thing. And not all Christian believers believed the same thing about the resurrection of Jesus. So if you go to the writings of the Apostle Paul, for instance, when he talks about the resurrection body in 1 Corinthians 15, he's talking about the nature of Jesus' resurrection and what should our expectations be concerning life after death.
So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body. 1 Corinthians 15, 42-44.
What Paul puts forward in 1 Corinthians 15 is really very close to the mainstream Greek view of that time, which you can find unpacked in the writings of Plato, for instance. And so that view is that we are primarily beings of consciousness, and that we existed as beings of consciousness before we individuated and incarnated as material beings. Now we're having this material experience, and then when our bodies expire, we continue as beings of consciousness and go on to an experience that's unimaginably different, or maybe we go around again. That was the Greek idea. And in 1 Corinthians 15, that's really the notion that Paul is putting forward. He says that we have a corruptible body that dies and decomposes, and that what goes on is a spiritual body. In other words, we continue as spiritual beings or beings of consciousness. Paul's view of resurrection does not require a dead body to be reanimated and then made indestructible so it can then carry on for eternity. That's not his view. His view is a spiritual one. And when he talks about his own encounter with the risen Jesus, he doesn't talk about encountering a reanimated dead body that's now indestructible. No, he describes a subjective experience of light and love and a changed life purpose and a voice that spoke to him. It's a spiritual experience that he describes, very similar to my own experience and the new birth experiences of countless believers from that time to this. So that's very different from encountering a reanimated body. And remember, he's talking about our resurrection and the resurrection of Jesus. Now, the Apostle Paul tells this story because he's reflecting on the Christian story, which appears to end with a dead Jesus. And he's wanting to say, no, the story doesn't end at death. The story is longer than that. Jesus transcended death, and so will we. And if we can't believe it of Jesus, how can we believe it of ourselves? So Paul is really preaching for that kind of a view, reflecting on a Christian story that, without what he's saying, ends with Jesus' death. If we go to the first and earliest iteration of Mark's gospel, which we find in the Codex Sinaiticus, it ends with the empty tomb and a promise of resurrection appearances. So Mark doesn't go into what those resurrection appearances mean, and he could mean exactly what Paul means. They're writing at about the same time as each other. Matthew, Luke, and John tell a different story. Their stories are of Jesus post the crucifixion as a reanimated dead body. Jesus come back to life from death. He can eat, he can cook food, but something is different about him that means he's going to go on for eternity. So there we have these different views of resurrection. The gospel writers use two words, one of which means he got up. And it's the same word you would use for someone who gets up in the morning, wakes up, and has breakfast. So he's had this crucifixion experience, he's been put in the tomb, and then he got up. And then the other word that is used means he was again. He got up and was again. And so some suggest that this doesn't mean resurrection in the classic Orthodox sense of a dead body that is supernaturally brought back to life. This is, in fact, a survival story. When we go to the Gospel of Mark in its earliest iteration, which we find in the Codex Sinaiticus, it ends a little earlier than the one that might be in your translation of the Bible, with an empty tomb and the promise of resurrection appearances. And so that gospel leaves open the question of what kind of resurrection this is, what kind of resurrection appearances these are. But Matthew, Luke, and John really nail everything down. Written a little bit later, they come along and they talk about resurrection as a reanimated dead body that's now indestructible and will go on forever. And that's the view that became orthodoxy. And that view is incompatible with a story such as from Rosa Ball that says that Jesus survived the cross and then made a journey to Kashmir, where he lived out the rest of his life as a teacher and the leader of the community of the healed, to die of old age at the age of 80.
Within the tradition of Christian esoterics, some believe that hidden in plain sight within the canonical texts is another understanding of the resurrection of Jesus. Narrative hints that perhaps Jesus did not die as a result of his crucifixion, but survived and escaped. This is also the teaching of another Abrahamic religion, Islam.
There are these tantalizing clues that there's something else going on in the canonical story that you can pull together to find a different explanation of Jesus's life after the cross. And the first is Pilate's dream. So Pontius Pilate is told by his wife, you must not be responsible for this man's death, because she's been warned about the consequences in a dream. And so we have Pilate, who's trying to find some way out of killing Jesus. So there's one little clue. And then we have the fact that Jesus' body comes off the cross between 3 and 6 hours after going onto the cross. Now, Roman crucifixions were absolutely brutal, and part of the torture of them was that it would usually take people days to die on the cross. So coming down after no more than 6 hours ought to get our attention. If the bodies had to come down early, the legs would be broken to prevent the poor victims from being able to push up and breathe. And this wasn't done to Jesus, so this attracts our attention. Jesus loses consciousness after he's given some mysterious mix to drink. This also gets our attention. Jesus's close associate, possibly his uncle, is on the Jewish ruling council, the Sanhedrin. This is Joseph of Arimathea, who has such access to Pilate that he can go in and say, I want Jesus's body, I'm going to place it in my family's tomb. He then has the authority to go up to the Roman guards guarding the crucifixion site and saying, I'm having that body, I'm placing it in my tomb. And they're so impressed with either the letter from Pontius Pilate or because they know who he is, that they hand the body over. All this should be catching our attention. And then there's the mysterious treatment that the body is given by the women when it's taken into Joseph of Arimathea's family tomb. These are all very odd things that are not the usual run of a Roman crucifixion. And some would argue, Christian esotericists would say, these are all references to a survival story, that Jesus was crucified, and the miracle is that what should have killed him didn't kill him. And they would relate this to words Jesus had spoken when he said, just as Jonah was 3 nights in the belly of a whale, so the Son of Man. And what's interesting about that is Jonah didn't die in the belly of the whale. He survived something that should have killed him. And this is the prophecy that Jesus makes about himself. And the final clue I'd mention is that to make sure Jesus was dead, a spear is thrust into Jesus' side and blood flows out of him. And I think the gospel writer may be putting a puzzle before us. What does that mean? Do dead bodies bleed? What kind of issue of blood was this? All these details raise these questions as to whether the canonical story is a story of one layer or two layers. Is it the story of a miraculous intervention by God bringing a dead body back to life? Is it a miraculous survival of a crucifixion? And why, in the earliest testament to Christianity that we can find, in the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel sayings of Q, is there no mention of the crucifixion and resurrection at all? Evidently, there were Christian communities for whom that was not part of the story.
But how could a religion have grown up around a miracle that didn't really happen? Many Christians object to the idea that Jesus could have escaped a hostile Jerusalem, retired to northern India, and allowed a whole religion to emerge on the basis of a misunderstanding of events.
Well, firstly, that's ridiculous because, of course, many narratives grew up in the name of Jesus. The Orthodox view grew up. Various Gnostic views grew up. Heterodox views grew up. We've already seen there were various resurrection narratives that grew up. Christianity wasn't a single thing from the beginning. It was a kaleidoscope of ideas and theologies and experiences and traditions. Does Jesus endorse all of those because they're all done in his name? I mean, think of all the things that have been done in Jesus' name throughout history. The enslavements, the misogyny, the imperial conquests. All these things have happened, but they've happened in Jesus' absence. Orthodoxy grew up in Jesus' absence. It became the imperial department of religion for the Roman Empire in Jesus' absence. The orthodoxy of the church was militarized by Emperor Theodosius in 381 of the Common Era in Jesus' absence. The canon of the New Testament was decided in Jesus' absence. You cannot point to things that emerged in Jesus' name and say, would Jesus have allowed that? He wasn't there. And you would have to apply the same logic to these questions of Jesus' resurrection. Would Jesus have allowed a false narrative of his resurrection to have grown up? Well, yes, if he wasn't there. Yes, if he was in another country. Christianity has been the construction of communities of faith and then traditions of the Roman Imperium in Jesus' absence. So I think the question really misunderstands the timeline of the formation of Christianity. Jesus didn't lay down the blueprint for an institution or for church services or for orders of bishops and archbishops and prelates or anything like that. All those things, all the traditions of Christian worship grew up in Jesus' absence. Jesus in the Gospel said, I did not come to be served, and yet a whole religion has emerged that seeks to serve Jesus. So you can see that something's gone awry in the name of Jesus. So that's how I would respond to that question.
The Gospel of Matthew asserts that Jesus began his life as an Israeli refugee living in Egypt, returning to Roman Palestine after the death of Herod. But what of Jesus' growing up years, of which we see only one moment at the age of 12 at the Jerusalem Temple? What did he do with the intervening 30 years? Did he, like those who wrote for him, make himself a student of international thought? Did he follow the well-established trade routes and travel the world on his spiritual journey? How credible is it that Jesus could have traveled as far as India?
International travel was relatively easy at the time of the Pax Romana. The world was so travelable that the Roman Imperial Army would dispatch soldiers from Italy to the very north of England, its border with Scotland, for a two-year posting. So clearly it was easy enough to get to and from Hadrian's Wall that you'd send a soldier there for only 24 months. There were well-established trade routes from east to west, and Jerusalem was superbly placed for international travel. There was regular trade along the Red Sea, and trade across the Indian Ocean was well-established. The trade routes were well-established, and Jesus could easily have traveled in that way and made international forays through that 30-year missing period in his early life. So yes, it's entirely possible that Jesus could have traveled. He has a 30-year gap in his timeline. If we follow the canonical stories, that's plenty of time for him to see the world. Is it not possible that Jesus was every bit as much a scholar of world thought as were those who wrote for him? It is possible that he was as studied and well-read as somebody like the Apostle Paul, who knew Plato like the back of his hand. Jesus traveling from Jerusalem to Kashmir is entirely feasible.
The claim at Hemis Monastery near Leh in Ladakh is that Jesus spent as much as 15 years during his teens and 20s living in India and studying at various monastic communities, including at Hemis Monastery, where his presence was documented in the community's written records.
The claim at Hemis is of written records from the time of Jesus, referring to this pilgrim from the Levant, this Isa. And they describe him as a young, holy man in his teens and 20s who had stayed for 6 years at Jagannath in Puri on India's east coast. Spent another 6 years in Nepal before coming to Hemis Monastery in Ladakh. If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Ancient Knowledge Academy is a safe space where we can sound each other out, speculate, explore, knowing that we are in a supportive and encouraging environment. It's an environment where we don't all have to agree about everything in order to be connected and support each other in our learning journey. And I look forward to welcoming you to the Academy. Sign up, and I'll look out for you. The claim at Hemis is of written records. The record in that documentation recalls him as a bit of a rebel, a bit of an anti-authoritarian, but very sincere, very devout, and loved and respected for that.
The tantalizing aspect of this story is that the written records have never been made public, yet they are not without historical witnesses.
Now, this documentation in the records of Hemis has been cited by a number of people through the years. In the 1930s, Maud Gask and Elizabeth Kaspari, who were spiritual scholars, travelled to Hemis, they saw the documents, and they took a photograph of one page of the document modelled to them by the local monk. I would love to apply some AI to this photograph and see if we can work out what's written on that text. They had made that trip to see that document hot on the heels of another spiritual leader, Swami Abedananda, who had made the trip in the 1920s. Again, he had asked to see the records, to see this documentation concerning this ancient pilgrim Isa and he was shown the same documents described by Elizabeth Caspary and Maud Gask. More than that, he was allowed to translate portions of what he was shown. Also in the 1920s, the Russian artist Nicholas Roerich made a visit to Hemis Monastery, and he too was shown the same documentation that had been translated by Swami Abhedananda and witnessed by Elizabeth Caspary and Maud Gask. These witnesses all confirmed what had been written and published in 1894 by Russian explorer Nicholas Notovich. Nicholas Notovich was the first scholar in modern times to bring Hemis's narratives about Issa to world attention. He translated the Hemis record and showed its correlation with Jesus's missing years. And he researched and found other Ladakhi, Punjabi, and Gujarati traditions which confirmed the Hemis narrative.
Unsurprisingly, Notovich experienced significant pushback. When he showed his research to two cardinals in Rome, both strongly urged him not to publish, either out of a pastoral concern for Notovich or because the implications of his work were simply too controversial. One of the cardinals offered to buy Notovich's research in exchange for Notovich signing an NDA, promising never to speak of what he had found. Notovich politely declined. The same offer was repeated by the Russian Orthodox Metropolitan of Kiev, but once more Notovich declined and published.
And he published his findings in the book La Vie Inconnue de Jésus Christ. The British establishment really pushed back against this narrative. And Max Müller, who was a German-born British scholar from Oxford University, he was a noted Orientalist and philologist, and he contacted a friend of his who lived in this part of India and asked her if she would go on his behalf to verify or falsify these claims made by Nicholas Notovich. Now, this was in the time of British India, and so his friend went with a delegation of British military / military police, because India was under British power at that time. And you can imagine why the dynamic of the conversation might have been slightly different when a British delegation with British military turns up at the door of Hemis Monastery and says, "We want to see the records. Was Jesus Christ ever here? Is there written proof? We want to see it." And the answer they were given was, "Oh no, there are no records of that kind here at all. And no, we don't know anything of a story of Jesus having been here. We don't remember having met Nicholas Notovich, so we can't confirm or deny that story either." It's not difficult to see why they might have been a little bit more defensive of the traditions they were maintaining when confronted with that kind of a conversation. Unfortunately, that meant that the report that went back to Max Müller was, "No, there's nothing in this." And Max Müller then, with all his authority, put that story forward, which was very damaging to Nicholas Notovich's reputation. It wasn't until later decades, when Nicholas Roerich, Swami Abhedananda, Maud Gask, and Elizabeth Caspary was shown the same documents that he had seen, translated parts, and even photographed a part of it. So in the long run, Notovich's story was borne out, but he had to suffer a lot of so-called debunking and pushback in his lifetime.
Clearly, conflicting narrative traditions cannot all be true. Turning to the narrative claims of the canonical Gospels, what is their credibility over and against conflicting claims from the east and west of India?
I think the first thing to remember is these are all narrative claims. It's not that the Orthodox story of Jesus has all this physical evidence lining up and supporting it, and these other narrative traditions, or there's no proof for them at all. No, there's no proof for any of them. They are all just narrative traditions. Even if you go to Jerusalem and are shown, well, this is the hill where he was crucified, or you go here and they say, well, this is the place where he was born, or this was the synagogue he attended. You might be looking at physical places and artifacts, but they are all stories. They're all narrative traditions. The question is how we weigh one narrative tradition against another. Is it corroborated by others? How old is the story? And I find stories of Jesus' travel to corroborate one another, especially when we get to India and find a number of monastic communities who will corroborate one another's account that, yes, Jesus was here. Jesus was here when he was younger. Jesus was here when he was older. What we have at Hemis is a claim of contemporary documentary evidence of Jesus. Documents from the time of Jesus talking about a figure that sounds like Jesus. We don't have anything like that for the canonical Orthodox stories about Jesus. Now, I find that Christian apologists and evangelists often pull a bit of sleight of hand over this issue. Oh, yes, we say there's plenty of evidence, contemporary evidence of Jesus. I mean, think about Josephus, Suetonius, Tacitus, Pliny. The problem is none of those were Jesus' contemporaries. Josephus was writing 2 to 3 generations after Jesus in the first century of the Common Era. Pliny was writing 3 to 4 generations after Jesus in the late first century of the Common Era. Suetonius was writing in the second century of the Common Era. Tacitus was writing in the second century of the Common Era, and all he's doing is reciting the emerged Christian Orthodox story that had solidified by that time. There's no one from the time of Jesus telling a story about him, unless what the monks at Hemis are saying is true, and they have a contemporary written account. That's what makes this so interesting.
But what is the nature of the canonical stories of Jesus? Is it possible that the whole Jesus story is an invention, a sequence of religious tropes sewn together to purvey new religious ideas and philosophies?
Because of the lack of contemporary evidence of Jesus that I mentioned before, I totally understand people saying this is a made-up figure. I mean, the Gospels are full of well-worn tropes from Greco-Roman literature, and it wouldn't be difficult to look at them and say, well, this is just a new version of some very old stories applied to the Christian hero. The missing body at the end of the Gospel of Mark, that's a trope which we will find in the hero story in many Greco-Roman stories, or the supernatural birth where the mother is a human being and the father is God. Well, there are many stories like that. Think of Alexander the Great. And so I can understand why people say this is just an agglomeration of old tropes that's been recycled and applied to the hero of the Christian story, to Jesus. It's all made up. Those tropes are used, but it may be they're being applied to a real historical figure, just as Alexander the Great was a real historical figure. The reason I believe there was a real historical Jesus is, firstly, he's a very inconvenient figure to have invented. Inconvenient to the Jewish religion, which had quite a comfortable relationship with the Roman Imperium. Inconvenient to the easy governance of the Roman Empire, if people are taking on the views of Jesus. Jesus' teachings about the money system, the tax system, leadership, feudalism, made him a very inconvenient figure to the Roman Empire, wanting an easily governed, compliant people. He's not the kind of figure you would invent. He is too inconvenient. And the distortion of the Jesus story reflects that. The fact that Jesus had to be changed and distorted in order to fit the Roman agenda, to me, it suggests there was an earlier Jesus tradition that was inconvenient. I mean, an example of how he's distorted is, of course, Eusebius' story of the cross in the sky, through which Jesus endorses the violence of Constantine's armies and endorses the legitimacy of all Constantine's invasions and military campaigns, endorses him as emperor. That's clearly a distortion of the Jesus of the Gospels. Or when you find Jesus portrayed in Ravenna, Italy, in I think it's the 6th century, there's a beautiful mosaic presenting Jesus in Roman military uniform as a foot soldier. So there he's now under the authority of the Roman emperor, about to be dispatched in violent campaigns against other people's countries. It's a very, very clear distortion. You can see how the church was brought into the feudalizing structures, with the bishops being accorded this kind of senatorial rank, these grand buildings being constructed for huge, pompous displays of power, all the ranks of society represented in the processions of those religious activities. You can see the change, you can see the distortion. And I think the distortion would only have been necessary if what first emerged in the name of Jesus was inconvenient to what the empire had in mind. So for those reasons, I believe there was a real historical Jesus about whom stories were then written. Orthodox stories, heterodox stories. Stories which became orthodoxy and stories which didn't. Stories in the Jerusalem-Rome tradition and other stories in other parts of the world.
Christianity has always been a kaleidoscope of ideas, theologies, stories, and experiences. Is this a weakness in the world of religious thought, or a strength? Why has mainstream Christianity been so defensive towards these international claims concerning the life of Jesus?
Christians often react to these stories, such as the Hemis story and the Rosa Ball story, because it raises questions about evidence. What is the evidence for the narrative you believe over and against this other narrative with which you might be less familiar? And I think orthodoxy prefers everything to be cut and dried. Doesn't want the uncertainty of this could be true or this could be true. It wants a story that it regards as proven, unassailable, cut and dried, this is how it is. And orthodoxy doesn't want this kind of confusion. So I think that's one reason. I think another reason is that it's such a clear reminder that in the early days, Christianity was a number of different narratives. I actually find that very interesting and very empowering. I want to know what the first Christians believed. I want to know the full spectrum of it, because I think it creates very interesting and motivating avenues of study. I find there's a very strong ascension teachings tradition when we go back to the full range of Christian literature in the early days. The Gospel of Thomas, I think, is like that. The Q sayings, I think, are like that. Some of the early Gnostic literature that is at the same time as the canonical literature is like that. It's about personal evolution. It's about human potential. It's about what can life be if we understand our unity with the divine, our unity with the source. It's an invitation to explore. And I find that invitation in the canonical gospels, such as Luke, and the non-canonical, such as Thomas. When Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is within you," that is an invitation to explore. When he says the kingdom of heaven is at hand, that is an invitation to explore. And when you get to the root meanings of those words and you realize kingdom could be translated realm, heavens could be translated space or the cosmos, and now we're talking about the whole cosmic realm being at hand. I can't imagine a greater, more profound invitation to explore than that. And that's what I find when I look at the full spectrum of those early stories. That's why I think it's good to recover the full breadth of what comprised Christianity in those early days.
What difference does it make whether people prefer the Jerusalem-Rome narrative, which has become Christianity's mainstream, or the claims of Rosa Baal in Srinagar, or the monastery of Hemis in Ladakh? In the final analysis, what difference does it make whether Jesus died in Jerusalem or in Kashmir?
The place really isn't the issue. I think the real issue here is the nature of the resurrection. Did Jesus die and then was his body reanimated, made indestructible, and then translated into space where it will exist forever? That's the Matthew, Luke, John story. Is that the case? Or is what Paul wrote closer to the mark, that we are all beings of consciousness on this interesting journey as beings of consciousness, material beings, beings of consciousness? We find it actually in the prologue of John's Gospel, where the writer says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Then the Word became flesh and had this material experience and dwelt among us." And then towards the end of John's Gospel, we hear Jesus praying to his Father and saying, "And now, Father, I'm about to return to you, back to the glory we enjoyed before the foundation of the world." So that life cycle that John gives to Jesus, Greek thought said, is true of all of us. Resurrection is something that will happen to all of us because it's just the natural cycle of life. A being of consciousness becomes a material being. And then it's the great repose, a return to the pleroma, a return to source after this material episode concludes. And I think what's different about that is that with the Matthew, Luke, John story, resurrection is something you can't be guaranteed. It's a miracle. So you'll have to be on the right side of God for that to happen to you. Better stay on his right side if you want a resurrection. Whereas, if the Platonic story, the Greek story is true, resurrection is just part of all our experience. It's something we can all look forward to. We've come into this material world to have material experiences, to be enriched by them, to have as good an experience as we can, and then we'll go on to something unimaginably different. And I find that to be a more compelling, more empowering story. The one that says, better stay on the right side of God, leaves us very open to manipulation by religious authorities, and it's not difficult to find examples of that through the ages. And so that's one of the reasons why I love talking about Jesus in India. A reminder that there are these other Christian narratives that have been there from the beginning, narratives that are not designed to manipulate and terrify, but to inspire, to invite us to explore, and to have the most extraordinary human experience possible.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind. If you enjoy our documentaries and interviews, sign up for Ancient Knowledge Academy, a learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Our courses will include navigating unexpected shifts and transitions in our lives, reframing faith and recovering from fundamentalism, living with close encounters and unexplained phenomena, learning to read the ancient cuneiforms of Sumer, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria, and reading them alongside the Bible. A virtual tour of Van Province in Turkey, digging into stories told by Bronze Age artifacts that take us into the world of the last ice age more than 10,000 years ago. 7 workshops in mindfulness and consciousness to heighten your cognitive powers, your intuitive capacity, and your capacity to manage stress. Finding the juicy bits in the works of Plato, and how to find and talk about paleo contact in the Bible. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to find out more.